From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Friday, June the 5th, 2020, and we have a good show lined up for you this morning. We're going to be speaking first off with John Hughes. He is a professor emeritus in constitutional law at St. Michael's College. And, of course, a lot of constitutional issues have been raised recently. Can the president of the United States order U.S. military troops to go out and quell unrest in our cities? Or is that something that needs to be left to our police departments? We'll get into that a little bit. We may ask about whether, under the First Amendment, it's permissible for a city to declare a curfew. Does the right peaceably to assemble and petition the government for a redress of grievances described in the First Amendment, does that go away at 8 p.m.? We might talk also a little bit about using unidentifiable troops of some sort to violently push back protesters who are peaceably assembled so that the president can go get his picture taken holding a Bible. We'll talk about that as well. The second half hour is some similar questions, but a different person answering them, and that will be U.S. Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont. He is a Democrat and has this week been highly and sharply critical of the president in several of these areas. We'll hear from Senator Leahy. And before I describe the second hour, I just want to mention that listeners, you're welcome to call in and join the conversation if you have thoughts that you don't feel are being reflected here or need to be entered into the conversation. Don't be shy. We're at 244-1777 and 1-877-291-8255 is the toll-free number. In the second hour of the program, I will say we are going to be getting done with the politics and going to boating safety. And my main guest then will be Sergeant Trevor Carbo of the Vermont State Police. We're just going to talk about things like how to be safe and legal out there on the water as you get out with your motorboat or sailboat or kayak or canoe or whatever it is you're using out there. There are some rules and there's some good advice. And with what looks like to be a nice weekend shaping up, I figured some people might be due for a refresher near the beginning here of our boating season in Vermont. All right, let's get right into it with John Hughes. As I mentioned, he's a professor emeritus of constitutional law at St. Michael's College. And Professor Hughes, thanks very much for joining me this morning.
Good morning.
Let's talk first about this question of kind of restrictions that run counter to the sort of very broad statements made in the First Amendment that we have freedom of speech and freedom of assembly, freedom of religion. There are asterisks, it seems, which don't really show up in my copy of the Constitution, but they do show up in the jurisprudence as unfolded since that document was written. So let's go first to restrictions on assembly, because obviously these have been really in play in the last couple of weeks.
Right. The First Amendment does say that the people have a right to peaceably assemble to petition government for a redress of grievances. And what kind of restraints can be put on that depend on, if I can quote real estate agents, location, location, location. The courts have defined a number of locations, forums, where demonstrative activity might take place. And the first one is what we call a public forum. And I'd like to quote just briefly from a Supreme Court decision in 1939 called Hague versus CIO, where the court wrote, streets and parks have immemorially been held in trust for the use of the public, and time out of mind have been used for the purposes of assembly, communicating thought between citizens, and discussing public issues. Now, there are other forums that the court has identified, like limited public forums or designated public forums and not a public forum. We don't have to go there because you'll notice it says streets and parks, and that would add to that sidewalks. This is the quintessential public forum. And any restriction on speech activities in a public forum has to meet, a very high level of justification. Forgive me for a little inside baseball here, but there are several levels of judicial review that courts use. And when it comes to restraints on speech activities in the public forum, it has to satisfy what the court calls strict scrutiny. What that means is that, first of all, the government has to be pursuing a compelling government interest, not just a reasonable one or a desirable one, but one of really enhanced importance. And the restraint has to be narrowly tailored to meet that compelling interest without unduly impinging on other speech activities. And, of course, it goes without saying that the regulation has to be content neutral. Again, we cannot discriminate among speakers as to what they're saying. So in a park, that's where First Amendment rights to gather and to demonstrate, if you will, are at their maximum.
And from your recollection of the facts Monday evening when the president had that famous photo opportunity of holding the Bible in front of the church after these what many people describe as unidentifiable troops or law enforcement personnel or you know, heavily armored folks were out there violently clearing these peaceful protesters from the area, from the park and from the streets around the White House. See a problem here?
Yeah. First of all, with the unidentifiable police, we don't have secret police in this country. Our police officers are identifiable. They wear a badge. It has a number. And if their identity is hidden, basically that's permission for them to act with impunity, because if you cannot identify the violator, then the violation didn't occur. And so I find the idea of unidentified police highly disturbing. And I don't know how many there were at Lafayette Park. I've heard stories about it. What we do know is that without much warning, they suddenly fired tear gas, rubber bullets, and concussion grenades into the crowd that had been peaceful up until then. And so that does not strike me as consistent with the First Amendment.
Just to tell all sides of the story here, let me interrupt for a moment and just to tell all sides of the story here. Kayleigh McEnany, the White House press secretary, made a statement in the last couple of days saying that some of the specific weapons on that list, the concussion I don't recall what she said about concussion grenades, but she said it was not tear gas. So it was apparently, she said, some other kind of chemical irritant or something that And so the media, of course, the fake news mainstream media got it wrong. That was the argument from the White House. But that doesn't really change the overall arc of this story, does it?
Not at all. Which
weapon was used?
That's right. You call it whatever you want. I think you're playing word games here. There was fire and gas that was an irritant that was admitted. It irritates the eyes, the nose, the throat, the lungs. Sounds like tear gas to me. Now, it may not be technically tear gas. It's something highly analogous to tear gas.
Everyone saw the video of people, in clouds of something, rubbing their faces and eyes and taking down their COVID-19 masks and, imposing more danger on themselves as a result of this police action by virtue of that.
That's correct.
So now we have this violence introduced into this scene by some type of law enforcement people, and so these protesters are basically driven off and prevented from their peaceful assembly to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Is that a violation of their constitutional rights?
It sounds like it to me. This would have to be settled by a court, and as of this morning, lawsuits have already been filed by the District of Columbia ACLU and several lawyers' committees on behalf of, I think, four or five protesters and the Black Lives Matter movement, and there probably will be others. And they've named Bill Barr, Donald Trump, and the Secretary of Defense as defendants. Now, how far those suits will go, I don't know. I'm not an attorney. I'm going to guess that they're looking for a declaratory judgment and possibly an injunction against the repetition of this, and maybe compensation for people who were injured. But it doesn't sound to me like this was narrowly tailored to meet a compelling government interest.
Well, Attorney General Barr is out with statements now saying that the White House wanted to push the perimeter back by a block. I guess there was some fear there, whether justified or not, because about a week ago or so, the president spent a little bit of time in the security bunker underneath the White House. He got some ridicule for that on Twitter, and he later said he was just inspecting the security bunker. So, you know, again, I try to give as much as I can all sides of the story here, because yeah. Maybe it was just maybe it had a long-term long-term planned inspection of the security bunker, just to go down and see what it looked like. Who knows? But the president the president was clearly I think concerned about people demonstrating, you know, anywhere near the White House, I guess. And so they wanted to this is in the narrative now presented by Attorney General Barr, who says they wanted to push the security perimeter back a block, and that was what that operation on Monday really was about. Now, it happened that minutes after that operation was conducted, again, you know, with quite a lot of force and violence and actual, you know, rubber bullets or pepper balls or tear gas or some other chemical irritant or whatever, the president appeared and walked over to the church there where people had been demonstrating a very short time before. And so does the Attorney General's narrative sound credible to you?
Well, the demonstration was not on White House grounds. The White House was secure. Lafayette Park is a place where demonstrations frequently occur. And I guess it's unfortunate that it's between the White House and the church that President Trump wanted to use for a photo op. But I don't find it credible at all.
And speaking of using a church for a photo op, let me ask you just for a moment about, you know, we used to talk about years ago, and maybe this is all out the window now with the rise of the Christian right and their increasing dominance in American politics, but we used to talk about a separation of church and state in our country. Of course, you know, we also have these national prayer breakfasts and all sorts of what could be construed by some people as entanglements of government and religion. Was this the right symbolism on that front?
It may have been for President Trump's base. I think that's rather ham-handed. I think he's been widely mocked and criticized for a poorly thought-out photo op, but he's certainly not the first president to invoke religion as a source of, let's call it, legitimacy or support. We have to understand that the First Amendment, although it does separate church and state, it demands neutrality towards religion, and neutrality is not hostility. And presidents, of course, can attend church services. Congress opens with an invocation every day. So the religion and politics are not completely separated. But yeah, that was kind of crude, and particularly when it was done without the permission of the church.
Well, that was my next question: is did the president basically impose himself on this religious community, whose bishop ended up saying he was not invited? They didn't, as the bishop put it, even get a courtesy call, and that basically the appearance by the president caused great strife at the church.
And he was on a sidewalk, which is also a public forum, and so, you know, he wasn't going into the church, but clearly he was trying to co-opt the church as a symbol. It seems incongruous that he would just at random happen to be there.
Yeah,
I don't buy the Secretary of Defense's argument that he didn't know that they were going to the church. I mean, he could clearly see. He knows that church is on the other side of the park. He could see where they were going.
The Secretary of Defense, I was actually surprised by that. Normally when, the chief person of the U.S. military goes out on any kind of a mission, he, you hope, knows where he's going, right?
Yeah, you would think.
I don't mean to be a wise guy here, but man, oh man, some of this stuff is, you know, let's see, am I doing a bombing run in country X or country Y? And oh, now I'm going across the street to a what? Yikes. Holy, not holy, maybe. I don't know. Anyway, 244-1777 is the call-in number here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM. Yeah, that's our local number in Waterbury. The toll-free number, 1-877-291-8255. And so, John Hughes, let me shift the focus here. Somebody suggested to me yesterday I focused too much on President Trump, and it's kind of tough sometimes because, you know, he is our president. Presidents traditionally have been kind of the leading newsmaker in the country. We do news analysis on this program, and so, gee, he's in the news every day. That's kind of the way the cookie crumbles. But I'm happy to ask you questions as well about cities that perhaps have Democrats for mayors, including New York, where this week on some evenings they were declaring an 8 p.m. curfew. And I did want to get into this with you because you know, the time, manner, and place restrictions on the First Amendment that have showed up in some of the jurisprudence, maybe they apply here. But again, these people, a lot of them were there peaceably to assemble. I love that unsplit infinitive, by the way. I never want to say to peaceably assemble. But anyway, that's just my old copy editor coming out. Peaceably to assemble to petition their government for a redress of grievances. And you know, the police are reacting by arresting them. And so I guess that's my question is, does that part of the First Amendment disappear at 8 p.m.?
Yeah, that's troubling. And I have to admit, I don't know what the status of curfews are. They would appear to be content neutral. I don't know if they're narrowly tailored to a compelling government interest. It seems to me that clearly there was lawbreaking going on. There was looting. There was violence. Those people can be dealt with separately. You know, I think you can deal with them with a scalpel and not a sledgehammer. And so curfews are disturbing, but I really don't know, without looking things up, I don't know if there's any case law on curfews. I know they've been used in the past. So.
Yeah, they have, and whether that's a trend that should grow or shrink in a country that has long prided itself on free expression, is an open question. Which I'm not gonna take sides on it right now, but I like to ask the question. I think it's worthwhile for sure. Let's go to a listener who's checking in. Jeff from West Braintree. Good morning, Jeff.
Yeah, you've been talking about the Trump deal there, where he went to the church. Those people were asked to move, and they wouldn't do it. Now, this Black Lives Matter deal, you've been glorifying these guys, and this Black Lives Matter outfit is nothing but a bunch of thugs. All they care about, they want to get rid of cops. They've stated so. They've in their signs that they hold up, and they want to defund all the cops. They want to let people out of jails because they want mob rule. They want to be able to do what they want to, when they want to, and they want to do it by force. If they were so interested in preserving black lives, why aren't they complaining about the murders of their own, by their own, in cities like Chicago, Baltimore, and others, where up to a dozen people or dozen black folks are killed at night by other black folks? Those lives, I guess, don't matter so much. You never hear anything about those. And another thing is, over in St. Johnsbury yesterday, they were asked to, they wanted to assemble, and they were asked to stay off the sidewalk. They were asked not to block the doors, and that's exactly what ended up happening. I watched the video time and time again. And they got in there, and the police chief said what happened, and which was they were stomping on their feet, they were elbowing them. And this one gal, she claimed she was knocked down. I did not see that. She fell backwards, and when you fall backwards on a set of stairs, you go downhill. And that's what happened. She shouldn't have been there anyway because she was asked not to be there. So this Black Lives outfit, they are a total bunch of thugs. And if they, like I said, if they were interested in peaceful assemblies, they wouldn't be smashing up our cities. They have killed their own. They've killed.
So Jeff, are you saying everybody who flies a Black Lives Matter flag or holds a banner that says Black Lives Matter is a thug?
You shouldn't be supporting that outfit. That's the work of the devil. No, I don't.
The work of the devil.
That is a terrible thing to fly the Black Lives Matter because they have no. They're not interested in saving black lives. They're interested in total mob rule when it gets right down to it. That's really what is going on. They've proved this. And the media, which you're involved with, the media, are too cowardly to call them out on what they really are, which is thugs. And they've smashed up businesses. Yesterday I saw on a video where these young ladies were scraping off.
Jeff, out of 100 Black Lives Matter activists, do you think are guilty of crimes? You know, if you were to do a per capita, out of hundreds, thousands? You need to work on your arithmetic, my friend. You can't have thousands out of 100. I don't know if you knew that from fourth grade fractions or anything.
I'm talking about in the country, all through these big cities, where these bands of people have traipsed down through the cities, my friend, and smashed up cars, smashed buildings, torn down stuff, stolen stuff. They're in there literally dragging out stuff. And another thing is,
hey Jeff, you've had enough things. I've got to get you off. Bye, Jeff. Folks, that is I got to say that's borderline. In fact, over the border into incivility here on the Dave Graham Show and WDEV FM and AM. I don't think. First off, I really urge against people describing almost any large group in derogatory terms because the derogatory charge almost, in fact, not I won't say almost, always misses the target on at least some members of that group. And so it's overgeneralizing and it's really... It's really unfortunate. I don't know whether I've seen some stuff online recently about how this people who identify with Antifa are allegedly all radical leftist thugs or something also. And I've tried to explain to people that, to my knowledge, Antifa actually is more of kind of a political stance than it is any organized group. But that is
that's correct. It isn't a group. At most, the social movement, it's actually more of a slogan than anything else.
Yeah. In fact, I'm going to say right here, I think that presentation there was just so bad that I'm going to say we're not going to be taking any more calls from Jeff from Braintree. He can call my management if he doesn't like that idea. But we're going to say, Jeff, get a life, my friend. So there we go. Anyway, back to my guest, John Hughes. And again, you know, I got to say, I've tried to say for the couple 2.5 years I've been doing this show, I welcome all views on the Dave Graham Show. But some are just when people start flinging insults and making these group generalizations like that, that's beyond the pale, and we're not gonna put up with that. So civility is important here, especially in these times. Frankly, the country has a lot of tension going on, and I don't want to have my show be out there inflaming anybody or whatever. So there we go. And I really regret, I regret, frankly. I know Jeff has very strong conservative views, and I regret it that it happens to be a conservative here who's just been banned from the show, but. It's kind of the way the cookie crumbles. We're doing the best we can. Anyway, John Hughes, let me ask you back to our conversation about this event Monday evening. So if these demonstrators, protesters, constitutional rights were violated, could a complaint be made that the president of the United States was actually violating his oath of office to uphold and defend the Constitution?
Certainly as a political criticism, yes. Could
that rise to the level of, an abuse of power, maybe for more impeachment proceedings?
Well, I don't think they're going to try impeachment again. It's certainly... The president does have an injunction in Article 2 to see that the laws are faithfully executed, and that means the Constitution as well. He takes an oath to the support of the Constitution, and the last thing a president should be doing is really inflaming violations of the Constitution. The president should be more of a uniter and a healer and not a provocateur. But that's what President Trump thrives on, for better or worse. He likes to appeal to his base, and he will do it in the most inflammatory language he can find.
John Hughes is a professor emeritus of constitutional law at St. Michael's College. He's been my guest this morning. And Professor Hughes, thank you so much for joining me. Sorry about the little dust up there at the end.
Right.
Have a good day.
Okay, thank you.
We are going to take a brief break here on the Dave Graham Show. Back shortly.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
News Radio, WDEV, FM, and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
And I just got to say, that warms my heart to hear that the Stowe Street Emporium is back, and things are waking up after a long, hard spring. So, hey, let's go to our next conversation here. My guest is U.S. Senator Patrick Leahy. I think most Vermonters know him. He's been around for a little while. And he has been making some quite strong statements this week about the situation going on with the police killing in Minneapolis of George Floyd and the reactions to it and the reactions to the reactions, et cetera. Senator Leahy, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Well, thank you. It's good to be with you, and I'm glad you've got Washington-type weather in the Waterbury-Montpelier area.
Well, I think it's going to be a little humid today, so Washington-type weather might be just the case, but that's okay. We'll take it. And in fact, I was just remarking earlier in the program, this is the first time I'm broadcasting from my porch today, and my only concern maybe was ambient noise. I hear a lawnmower in the neighborhood, but it's distant enough. I don't think it's bothering our listeners, so we should be okay.
I love sitting on the front porch of our home in Middlesex and just looking down over the valleys. But I've been homesick because I've been stuck in Washington much with quarantines and everything else.
Yeah. Senator, we got to talk about some of what's been going on in Washington, and you came out with a very strong statement critical of a couple of things that have been brought about by the Trump administration recently, among them this discussion and now in the Capitol District use of troops in trying to patrol domestic protests. Tell us about the history of that, because you made a remark indicating to me that you know some of that history and that there is that this is not unprecedented, but it's worrisome, I guess, is the best way I think I would sum up your concerns about it.
The only time when you've seen troops really come in is when there's been a request from the state, for example, the L.A. riots, but there's absolutely no need for it here. This was done as a total photo op. I think one of the most beautiful spots in demonstration of democracy is the Lincoln Memorial in Washington. And when you see yesterday or the day before, every single step lined up with troops in full battle gear. This is where Martin Luther King gave his "I Have a Dream" speech. This is a place where I remember when my parents were with us, bringing them down to see it, our children, our friends, my sister, my brother, and others.
just to see this is democracy. Now they made it look like it was something in a dictatorship. And so much of this has come because the president wanted to show what he thought was strength. He's talking about this is what we do with the military. Well, here's a man who dodged the draft five times, does not have an understanding of what the military stands for, and we do not need the military when you're having peaceful demonstrations. And I think what's happened, and one of the reasons they've raised the curfew and done away with the curfew in several places, is that they know the enforcement of the curfew has caused more trouble than otherwise. But what the president was showing is that I don't care what the grievances are. He'll point to the people who broke the law, and there were those, and they should be arrested, and they should be charged. I mean, the vandalism and things like that. But the vast majority of people were there to show that if there's a murder of a man by a police officer, and with three other police officers standing by complicit in it, of course they're going to demonstrate. And when the president says, we've got to have, do everything you can to have the military clear these people out, because he wants to go and do a photo op in front of a church holding a Bible, which he's never read, and he certainly doesn't follow, and once it's only for a photo op, in the meantime, people are injured, and the military is made to do things they're not supposed to do. This is wrong.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that Monday evening confrontation in Lafayette Square. It sounds like you thought that these protesters would have a right under the First Amendment peaceably to assemble and petition the government for a redress of grievances, to use the words of that amendment. Is there any credible evidence or reports that they were doing something different from that at that time?
No, there isn't. We do know that in some parts around the country there was vandalism, and I think the police are taking steps against those who committed vandalism. But not so, here. These people were protesting peacefully, and the Episcopal bishop made a very, very strong statement against the president's use of a photo op. I mean, he wanted to say, here's where I'd want to go to church. He doesn't go to church. Everybody knows he doesn't go to church. Everybody knows he's never read the Bible. A couple of times when he's tried to quote something from the Bible, he's gotten it wrong. To stop a peaceful protest, to do a photo op, I don't care if you're a Republican or a Democrat. That is absolutely wrong.
I was hoping he'd drop the Bible and it would accidentally sort of open to the page that says, blessed be the peacemakers, right?
Yeah, well, sort of. he would say that was false Bible.
False Bible, false gospel. Okay. I got to get back to these questions here because I don't know how much time you have, but I do want to get to them. So when the president ordered the area cleared and condoned the use of force with the use of, now this is in dispute which exact weapons were used, but I don't think it makes a difference. You know, was it chemical balls or was it tear gas or was it some other chemical irritant? Was it rubber bullets or bean bags or who the heck knows? But clearly there were these weapons used in an act of violence by law enforcement / military people to drive the peaceful demonstrators out of the area. And when that happened, when that act occurred, did that violate the protesters' First Amendment rights?
I believe it does, because you have a right to peacefully assemble to seek redress from your government. This is what sets us apart from dictatorships. In dictatorships, when people try to protest like this, as we've seen in countries around the world, the police and the military come in, arrest the demonstrators, disperse them. We've seen this in Iran and North Korea, China.
Egypt, the Arab Spring, famously.
Egypt, the Arab Spring, and several others. This is America. This is America. I grew up in Montpelier. I remember the number of times people would march up to the state house. They'd have some in one position, some in the other. And we all said, yeah, boy, we Vermonters know how to say what's on our mind. Well, that's what these people are doing. We Americans are trying to say what's on our mind. We should be allowed to do it. We're not a dictatorship, I hope.
Okay, so if the president and or his agents violated the protesters' constitutional rights, and I'm saying in a fear, I'm taking a position myself because I'm trying to be a neutral journalist here. But if that happened, did the president violate his oath to uphold and defend the Constitution?
The argument could be made that he had. Whether the argument will be made, I don't know. I think what you're going to find that this may well be a tipping point in the election this fall.
Could it be new grounds to commence or resume impeachment proceedings, possibly with a new count of abuse of power?
Technically, that could be argued. Of course, that'd be up to the House. I doubt very much that they would, and Mitch McConnell would not allow it to come to a trial in the Senate, so it becomes a moot point. What I think we have to do is say, listen, we've listened to falsehoods and everything else that the president said over and over and over again. The one thing that we usually find Republicans and Democrats united on, we want our military to be independent, to follow the law, to protect America. And the president went so far over the line in trying to politicize the military, that you have people like General Mattis, who had been Secretary of Defense, a highly decorated combat Marine, and he came out with a very, very strong statement. In fact, I spoke about it on the floor of the Senate yesterday, mm-hmm. put his statement on the record. And Admiral Mike Mullen, who had been the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, again, highly respected, highly decorated, he spoke out. And when I called him at home afterward, he said he tries never to say something critical of any president, but this went so far over the line, he felt that if he really believed in the Constitution, he had to speak out. Now, this should send some alarm in people's minds. I don't care whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. If a president feels they can use the military for a political purpose, that's gone beyond anything this country has seen in my lifetime. And I've been there with Republicans and Democrats as president. I'll give you another thing that comes to my mind. Here you have this, really the murder of Mr. Floyd. I was a prosecutor for 8 years. I looked at those videos. There's no question I would have brought murder charges in that case. And it's obvious that so much of the country was torn apart by it. Now, in the past, with presidents, again, of both parties, when something like this happens, they come as the consoler in chief. Think of Ronald Reagan after the space shuttle blew up, and when he spoke to a grieving nation, or after the Oklahoma City bombing, Bill Clinton going out there, or George Bush after 9/11, linking arms with Republicans and Democrats on the steps of the Capitol, and Barack Obama in a church grieving over the murder of a number of blacks, and he quietly sings Amazing Grace, bringing the country together. That's what you do at a time like this. You don't go and say, oh, wait a minute, this is hurting my polls. Somebody might find out I was down in the secure basement. We've got to do something to show I'm strong. And then having the military set up a photo op of a man holding a Bible in front of a church and then going before another one the next day. This is a man who doesn't go to church. This is a man who's never read the Bible. This is a man who uses this just for politics, and I think that went so far over the line that that's why you're now hearing Republicans speaking out. Before they were in the Senate, they just do it quietly in the cloakroom. Now they're speaking out publicly.
Boy, that's I gather you may be a little reticent about two-pointed criticisms at your fellow senators, but Lisa Murkowski, just one example, a Republican of Alaska, in the last 24 hours has been taking a lot of heat online along the lines of, you know, she seems to be having some softening of her support for the president. And there's a lot of snark out there basically saying, you know, you think you're late to the party and
she's been. I went and saw her yesterday, and just to say, you know, we've always been friends. Her father served in the Senate, and her father and mother are friends of Marcel's and mine. Lisa joined me as the senior Republican on a delegation I brought to Vietnam, where we used the Leahy War Victims Fund, something that's helped improve relations between our countries. She came with us. She's a thoughtful person. And I went to her and said, you know, I was proud of her and so on. We've always been friends. And she said, it's not worth saying I can be silent so I can get reelected.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, it's a tough thing to go against the leader of your party, the president of your party. These, however, are extraordinary times. And again, I've tried to explain to people on the show here that I don't do this on the basis of ideology. It's not because I consider myself a strong Democrat or a strong Republican. It's really all my criticisms at the president, which have been pretty sharp at times and draw a lot of complaints, frankly, from some of our more conservative listeners. You know, I think I have based these my criticisms mainly on behavior, mainly on, you know, when a president comes out and tells four congresswomen of color that they should, quote unquote, go back where they came from. That's the kind of phraseology that is really, really problematic, you know, because it rings a bell and sounds an echo of some very racist things that have been said in our country over the centuries. And when he talks about Henry Ford, the famous anti-Semite and Nazi sympathizer, having good bloodlines, again, just the language, you know, blood purity was a huge thing with the Nazis. You sort of have to, it makes you sit up and take notice.
Yeah, you loot, we shoot. I mean, that, I look at the dignity of John Lewis, Congressman John Lewis, and I'll be talking to him later today and speaking how we should resist these things. We should stand for the Constitution. We should stand for the rights of all people. And when Congressman Lewis came to Burlington and spoke there a few months ago at the Flynn Theater, we had to set up extra times for him to speak because these overwhelming, the number of Vermonters who wanted to come and hear him speak. And these were Vermonters. I knew a number of them. They went across the political spectrum. It being our state, a predominantly white audience. And they wanted to hear what he said about people's rights. Everybody, I think it's one of the most moving things I have seen in all my years in Vermont, having him speak. Now, I've been in meetings, both public and many private, with every president since I've been there, Republicans and Democrats, when there's been crises like this. And every one of them, Republican and Democrat, said, how do we bring the country together? And they've had in some of these meetings, we've had other senators who go across the political spectrum, and they said, "How?" And everybody's saying, "How do we bring the country together?" In this case, we know now that what Trump was saying, this is hurting me in the polls. It's bad enough I got hurt by COVID, where they responded so poorly. We got to do something. I got to show how strong I am. I am the law and order president.
Yeah.
That's not the time for that. This is Senator, we have a console people, bring people together.
Senator, we have a couple of listeners on the line. If they're still there, I've been neglecting them a bit. I apologize, folks.
I get so wound up. I get so wound up with this.
We get into these conversations. Yeah, I know. I know I guess it's a common thing. But let's go to Doug in East Montpelier. Good morning, Doug.
Yes.
How are you?
Not too bad. Hey, I keep hearing about this was all a photo op. Wondering if you listen to Bill Baird's news conference yesterday explaining what happened.
Well,
I listened to it along with a number of other senators, both Republicans and Democrats from the Senate Judiciary Committee. All of us know him, and all of us said, what are you talking about?
You didn't buy his explanation, Senator.
Well, I didn't hear a single Republican or Democrat say they agreed with him. They thought that it was wrong for the Attorney General to be there helping to arrange a photo op. It was wrong for the Attorney General to be there in trying to carry out the political wishes of the president. The Attorney General is supposed to be outside of it. He's supposed to be the Attorney General of the United States, not the Attorney General of the president. He's different than most other cabinet officials. And there was not a positive reaction by anybody, Republican or Democrat. And we went across the political spectrum if you look at our Senate Judiciary Committee.
Doug, anything else?
Were there hundreds of Secret Service and other agents injured the night before and the night before that? It would make sense that they'd want to move.
Service? No, yeah. Hundreds of Secret Service agents, no. You did have the tweet from the president saying that they were going to have ominous weapons and the most vicious dogs ever seen, and the Secret Service wanted to put the young people in the front to so they could learn to fight all these people. And the Secret Service very quietly said, no, that never happened. And I think there's a difference between what the president tweets out and what happens. Now, again, I spent 8 years in law enforcement before I was in the Senate. I don't want to see any police officer or law enforcement person who is doing their job the way they're supposed to be injured or to be hurt. I took that same position when I was state's attorney. I take it now. But the case was the Secret Service is there to protect the president, the White House. That's why they put him down in the bunker at one point, something he later denied, even though they did put him down there. They're not there to do a political photo op.
I don't think it was a photo op. They were moving the perimeter back, and that was in place before he went over.
You've got a different view of it than those who have reported to the objectively to the Senate Judiciary Committee.
The fire police, their report, is that some perimeter too?
And in fact, you had fire police, you had DEA, who should not have been there, and they now admit that. This, for one thing, you just watch the videos. This was a peaceful protest, and all of a sudden there's these smoke canisters going off. Whatever they were, they're obviously causing people to have sight problems. You had a medevac helicopter flying over, and everybody's wondering, what the heck is that doing here? And all they had to do was say, look, the president wants to come over and set it up, and it would have been done. The way this was done, nobody, I haven't heard a Republican or a Democrat say, yeah, this was done right.
Let me go to another caller here. Thanks for the call, Doug. Let's go to Mark in Middlesex. Make it quick because we're almost done out of time, Mark. Sorry.
Yeah, no problem. Patrick, the boys are just up your place moving some wood up there, Mark, up on the Brook Road there. My question is, with this posse comitatus that was taken out of our law, what possible repercussions or, liberties does...
Posse comitatus, what do you know about that, Senator?
Well, posse comitatus says that, in effect, that the our military does not act as police officers in our country. They're mm-hmm. to defend us from enemies abroad, not to be a police force here. That is so that we don't fall into the same category as some of these dictatorships around the world. There is the use of the Insurrection Act, which would require the Congress to react to it. And this saying that we're going to have the military come in and be our police force, that would be a total violation of posse comitatus.
All right. Well, Senator Patrick Leahy has been my guest. Sir, I thank you very much for joining me this morning. We are about out of time, but I really appreciate you taking some time with us, and have yourself a good weekend. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you very much.
All righty. Let's go to top of the hour break for some CBS News, some words from our sponsors. Bob Nail will be joining us, as he does on Fridays, and we'll be talking about boating safety. It's a nice, calm topic, I hope, in the next hour. We'll be back, folks. Stay with us.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren Store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
We are back, and we're going to be talking in just a moment or so, I think, with Bob Nay. He's one of our national correspondents, a real stalwart on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV, FM, and AM. Bob's an interesting guy, former Republican congressman from Ohio, got himself into a lot of trouble in the Jack Abramoff lobbying scandal back in the almost 20 years ago now, actually, and ended up doing a little bit of time in the federal pokey. He's seen life in America from high up and member of Congress and low down, a federal inmate, and has some very interesting perspectives, I think, that he brings to the Dave Graham Show. We're always really, really pleased to have Bob be a continuing member of our team here. He joins us on Friday mornings for the national perspective we like to apply here just after the midpoint of the show, when we do that 10 o'clock CBS News, and then bring in. Lately, we've also been leaning on some of our CBS News correspondents who are willing to get out on the phone with us individually. That's pretty cool. And Axios has been helping out. They're great, too. So Bob takes his turn today, and I believe he's on the phone with us now. Good morning, Bob Nay.
Hey, good morning, Dave. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm hanging in there watching the world revolve.
Man, oh, man, the world is I had a Congressman Peter Welch from Vermont on the show earlier this week, and this reminded me of this book I read back in high school called Future Shock by Alvin Toffler, all about how events were going to start in chronologically coming closer together and overlapping, et cetera, et cetera. And then on Monday, I was reminded of this because the congressman and I were talking about how, you know, he said, well, 1918 was a terrible year for America with the Spanish flu pandemic, and 1929 was a really tough year with that economic downturn that led to the Great Depression. The 1968 was a difficult year for the nation with all the civil unrest connected with, and frankly, a lot of police brutality that year connected with both with the civil rights protests and also with the anti-war protests and the Democratic Convention, I recall, of that year. So a lot of civil unrest. 2020, we've got pandemic like 1918. We've got economic crash as a result of the pandemic like 1929. And we've got civil unrest all in one year. What are we doing?
Well, you forgot killer bees and an asteroid.
Man, oh man, that's right. I mean, listen, I wouldn't be shocked at this point, you know? I mean, what the heck is going on here?
Exactly. Exactly. Tough, tough time.
Yeah. So what is your, out of all of this, what do you got as your lead headline today?
Well, I mean, there's so many lead headlines. I mean, if you look around the world, just going international first, the lead headline is the 31st anniversary of Tiananmen Square massacre. Obviously, you know, 10,000 people were massacred 31 years ago. And, of course, there's
1989, yeah.
Yep, right in Hong Kong and Taiwan over this. That's the international side. And then there's a basically a prisoner swap, although we're not admitting it, with one of our American citizens coming out of Iran and one of the Iranian scientists going back to Iran. So, but they're not admitting it's a swap, but it's a swap. Let's face it. But, you know, the big story, of course, upon the memorial of George Floyd, on the heels of that, remembering, you know, how this all started, you know, the spark, George Floyd and his life was, you know, commemorated yesterday and remembered yesterday. But also everything and the aftermath out of it. But if you ask me to pick kind of the top story, because there's so much going on around the country and nice protests, not so nice protests, and in between, you know, et cetera, and arguments about issues and how we solve this. But on top of it, I think the story that if you could just pinpoint a headline is the president, the military, and who moves next. And I say that because Attorney General Barr has come out and said, well, he cleared out the protesters down at Lafayette Park when the president did the, you know, Bible in front of the church, Dave, as you know.
Yeah.
My question would be is, since when does the attorney general make a phone call and tell people to get rid of protesters? I mean, Secret Service has jurisdiction, you know, on that issue. And the military chopper flew low. Now, our Secretary of Defense, Esper, is actually looking into why that chopper flew low, who ordered that. And then the Congress is looking into, you know, some of the military issues. But I picked that as a personal headline because I think you've got, you know, states that have either handled it, you know, okay or bad or whatever, and police departments that have handled things okay or bad or whatever, you know, that can be analyzed and dealt with and people can have opinions. There's a new mix here, and it's the President of the United States saying about, you know, he's going to send troops into states that he doesn't think are doing the job. And I'll tell you what I'm seeing and hearing, not from the top brass, but from people I've known for years in military is becoming very nervous and very uncomfortable with this.
That's the impression I get from the reports I read in reliable media coverage out there. And, you know, I mean, it's so weird because in the past, I remember, you know, growing up in the 70s and 80s, and we'd hear about revolutions and other stuff happening in Latin America and so on. And you know, sometimes the question would come up was, okay, the dictator wants to do such and such. Is the military going to be with him, you know, et cetera? And, you know, too often that was the case, and there were bad acts going on, horrible stuff happening at the behest of the dictator and carried out by the military. Occasionally, you'd have, you know, rifts developing, and the United States, which then was trying to be, you know, a force for stability and democracy and so on in some of these places, was basically rooting for the rift, right? You know, the divide between the despot and the military, and. I've never really understood, or I never really expected that we'd be having, you know, similar. We have foreign correspondents working in our country right now for you know, legitimate journalistic enterprises in all over Europe, in Israel, Australia, et cetera, and they are writing stories about this, like this rather, about us.
Right. Correct.
I find that to be really, frankly, not a not a welcome development. I find that to be extremely scary. And I do think that when that becomes the possibility, then it start, you have really have to start to say, well, the other question that always comes up with these other countries that are very poorly run and not really stable democracies, are they going to be able to administer a free and fair election, right? And
that's right.
What do you think? Are you worried about the overall conduct of our upcoming election? Are we going to see any kind of, you know, really serious tampering with it, or are we going to, you know, I mean, the political commentator and sometimes comedian Bill Maher is out there saying he thinks that even if the president is trounced in the election, he's going to refuse to leave. And then I guess you have to try to game that out and say, well, what would happen? Would there actually be, you know, some troops under some command entering the statehouse to remove him or the White House?
That would happen because I just, and it wouldn't be a military coup, but I think the military would not tolerate, you know, going against what the election system has said. And I hope it never gets down to that. You know, who knows? But as far as the free and fair elections, you know, we've done fairly good. Congressman Steny Hoyer is the number two Democratic member in the House, right after Speaker Pelosi. And Steny Hoyer and Ted Kennedy, and I'm pretty safe in saying most of your Northeastern legislators voted for an act that Steny and I did to make sure that elections were, you know, fair, and that every vote could be counted, and make sure that people weren't turned away, but make sure that there was no fraud. And it's functioned quite well. So, you know, having a kind of a vested interest in the legacy bill that Steny created the idea to do at that time, you know, I'm looking at this, and there's a elections commission. I surely hope that they give their expertise as possible. And also, where this could all throw a big curve, I think, is if somebody decides to postpone the election. Now, we can argue about mail-in ballots and line going in person to vote or whatever. If somebody tries to move that election, I think that would just scare a lot of people in this country big time.
And let's say they wanted to vote out whoever was made the decision to move the election. They wouldn't really be able to do that if the election were postponed, correct?
Well, that's right. You know, we had a postponement of the elections by our health director, not actually the governor of Ohio. And that, even though people feel he's doing a good job, that has left a taste, you know, the bitterness in a lot of people's mouths of her, you know, doing it herself. So I think
on the Ohio primary, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, the Ohio primary. And I can safely say both sides were a little bit upset about, you know, how it was done. Not that it was done, postponed, as much as how it was done. But a federal election, how on earth could you postpone or move a federal election? So I would say, yeah, if they try to move it, and then what do you do? How do you vote against the people that wanted to move it? I just can't imagine how that would go down. I think that would make total chaos in the United States.
Can mail-in ballots work? I mean, I see complaints from some Republicans in particular who think there's just a lot of security issues when you have people voting in their own kitchens or whatever.
Well, I mean, I think we have to look at the fact of what we have had in states, our history of absentee ballots. Now, people tell me, well, Bob, that's different. Well, it's really not. You get a ballot, and if my mom and dad, you know, are sitting down and filling out their ballot, you know, do they fill it out or do they seek advice from somebody in the house? I mean, who knows? That's their right to seek advice from somebody in the house. And if somebody has passed away, there's ways to find out that ballot doesn't count.
All right, Bob Ney, I got to move along, but I appreciate you taking some time with us this morning. It's always good chatting with you. Let's do it again soon.
You too.
Last week, we had a discussion about with a couple people from the Vermont Department of Fish and Wildlife about sort of boat launch ethics. You know, who's next in line? How to be polite and deferential toward one another when you're getting your boats in and out of the water. et cetera, et cetera. Then it occurred to me, I said, we didn't really cover the whole question of, so how about when you're out on the water? There are definitely some rules, maybe more stringent rules. Not many rules really apply to that boat launch scene, but there are rules out on the water. And I said, I should pursue this whole boating thing a little more thoroughly, especially this time of year. You know, we're just getting into the season now. You go out to your local lakes and ponds and so on, and there's a lot of people out there wanting to kayak and motorboat and sail and canoe and all the rest of it. And so I called the Vermont State Police, and I said, do you have somebody who oversees boating safety there and can kind of fill us in on what some of the rules and the laws are and et cetera? And they said, yes, we do. We have Sergeant Trevor Carbo. And so Sergeant Trevor Carbo is my guest this morning. And Sergeant, thank you very much for joining me.
Good morning, Dave. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Excellent. And so let's talk a little bit about this. Obviously, you know, everyone wants people to be able to enjoy Vermont's waterways, lakes, ponds, rivers, et cetera. And also everyone wants people to be safe and careful enough to be safe. And but every year it seems we lose a few people in boating accidents. And I'm wondering, is there sort of an annual average of how many drownings occur in boating accidents in Vermont?
Yeah, it is unfortunate, Dave. I'd like to say over the last 20 years, Vermont, you know, knock on wood, has been fairly fortunate. Although, you know, any life is too many lives to lose out on the waterways. We don't see a whole lot each year. We average somewhere around two or three. Mm-hmm. Coincidentally, unfortunately, last year we lost a high of five. We had five boat drownings in Vermont last year. That does not include, you know, swimming drownings.
Right.
This is strictly anything that's attached to a boat incident.
Right. And is there any sort of, I mean, maybe the stats are too small really even to ask this question, but I'm going to try anyway. Is there any commonality, anything that is a trait that is, similar between, say, these five incidents that really tells you this should be highlighted as a thing not to do?
Yeah, unfortunately, one of the biggest and most glaring issues, and yet some of the easiest to solve, is just a lack of life jacket wearing by those that that have lost their lives out here. Very few that have drowned were wearing life jackets.
I see. The rule, if I recall it, is that you are supposed to have on board the vessel a number of life jackets equal to the number of people on the vessel, and that if anyone is 13 or younger, or maybe it's 12 or younger, tell me what the cutoff is there. They're supposed to be wearing their personal flotation device, life jacket, for the entire time they are out on the boat, correct?
Yeah, you're correct, Dave. If you're out on a boat and you're the operator, you need to make sure that you have a life jacket for every person that you have on board. Not just having a life jacket, but having the appropriate life jackets that fit the people that you have on board, whether it be children, et cetera. And if you're under 12 and you are underway on the water and you're out on an open deck, if you're under 12, you have to be wearing that life jacket. But I think one of the problems we see is that folks will have life jackets on board, but they most oftentimes are stored, you know, under their seats in their storage compartments. Mm-hmm. You know, we've rolled up on and done checks, safety checks on boats, and someone will take 5-10 minutes to pull out the six life jackets for the people that they have on board. You know, if you have a sudden equipment issue on your boat that takes on water, say a through hole valve lets loose, and your boat's going to sink in a matter of a minute. You don't have time to get those life jackets. So we encourage people to, once you get underway, is get those life jackets out and at least available. If you just refuse to wear it, at least get it out available where it's accessible should you need it in a matter of seconds.
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting point you make there, that distinction between, yeah, that we have the proper number of life jackets and even the proper sizes on the boat. That's a consideration. But that question of actually having them easily accessible when you need them is really is I'm sure that makes a difference in some instances. And, you know, again, it's just a sort of a word to the wise. But actually, more than a word to the wise, also there's some enforcement involved, from what I understand. If you violate these rules about having sufficient life jackets on your boat, what is the penalty?
Yeah, it's a big enforcement effort for us. And that is one thing that we have little tolerance of. Give me just a second here. We've got a large, I've got a long list of fines here that these are all mixed in. So it'll take me a second just
to sort it out.
Find that exact section. That exact section. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm gonna just continue chatting here for a minute while you look that up, Sergeant. And I think, you know, the point of this here is, folks, the listeners out there, you know, I'm a boater myself. I have a little sailboat and love it. Love getting out on the water. I think it's really just kind of a cool thing to get out there in nature and enjoy the, you know, if it's a sunny day and the breeze and you know, in my case, the being propelled by the wind when you have a little sailboat is really quite a treat. And it is a very, very enjoyable activity. I think that people are you know, I say go for it. But what did we come up with there, Sergeant? Did you find a number, or maybe that's
Right now the surcharge is it would be a $70 fine. You know, $70. We try and do our enforcement efforts out there is mainly about education. We really push the education to folks out there. We're not looking to ruin folks' day out there. This is a recreational enjoyment activity. So our main focus out there is to make sure that folks are safe. We try and get to these folks ahead of time and make sure that we get them safe before they head out on the waters.
Hey, one question I had about the dangers. The five boat-related drownings you had last year in Vermont, what was the breakdown on Lake Champlain versus on other bodies of water, if you recall or know?
I want to say the majority of them were on Lake Champlain, unfortunately. I can think of three right off the top of my head. And unfortunately, one of those was, you know, we would consider improper wear of a life jacket. Somebody didn't have time to get it on before they ran into an issue out there in the water. And it ended tragically for them.
Yeah. And I think that's something worth noting, only because Lake Champlain, I mean, and I don't mean to give anybody a pass on other bodies of water. You know, other lakes around Vermont are beautiful, and some of them certainly are large enough to go out and enjoy a motorboat exploration or a sailboat trip or whatever. But Lake Champlain is really, a kind of a beast unto itself here in Vermont. It's definitely our largest body of water. You can be, you know, miles from shore. Obviously, distance from shore is going to make a difference if you're in trouble. I mean, am I on track there, Sergeant?
Yeah, you sure are. It's, you know, Lake Champlain is 124 miles long, and I think it's 14 miles at its widest point. It definitely is its own animal out there. The weather changes quickly. It's broad, so that when the weather does come up, it can get pretty awful, and very, very quick change of temperature as well, which unfortunately has gotten some folks in trouble.
Yeah, that is something to consider for people who, especially I would guess, you know, inexperienced boaters. Do you think they might be better off on a Lake Carmi or Lake Fairlie or one of the others around the state?
Well, you know, even inexperienced, you can get in trouble anywhere. But I would say that if you are inexperienced, you know, make sure that you're aware of where you're going. Don't venture too far from shore out on the lake. And just be aware of the weather. make sure that you're checking the weather. It can be a beautiful 85 to 90 degree day, calm as glass, and then you know, a minute later you can have 60 mile an hour winds.
Storm comes up through.
And you can find yourself in real rough conditions out there.
Sergeant Carbo is my guest, Vermont State Police, and we're going to continue our conversation on the other side of a bottom of the hour break for a CBS News Minute and a couple words from our sponsors. And Sergeant, thanks so much for participating so far. Let's do a little more after the break. All right, let's go. And by the way, before we do, I wanted to quickly to mention, just after 11 o'clock today, the governor's news conference. Governor Phil Scott and other top state officials will be talking about the COVID-19 response that they've been doing every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And they're going to do that just after 11. We're going to carry it live on WDEV, FM, and AM as we have been. So stay tuned for that as well, folks. More about boating safety on the other side of the break coming up.
We're opening up stairs at the Warren store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
Thanks for staying with us into the last half hour of our program this morning on this Friday, June the 5th, a beautiful Friday morning, June the 5th. I've been broadcasting from home lately, and I'm doing so today from my porch. It's been quite enjoyable out here. It's the first time I've dared to come out to the porch for the morning broadcast. And so far, I haven't been too much disturbed by a barking fit by my dog or too loud chirping birds or anything. So I think this might work for a little bit. Anyway, we'll see how it goes for the last half hour here. My guest is Sergeant Trevor Carbo. He is with the Vermont State Police, and he is their person in charge of boating safety and has some interesting observations and tips and advice about just what the rules and regs are and so on out there on the water. And Sergeant, one of the other topics I wanted to cover with you this morning, I guess you might call it BWI, or boating while intoxicated. Are there laws against that? And let's talk a little bit about whether you've seen that as any kind of a serious danger in the investigations you've done of boating accidents.
Yeah, it's certainly on the books as against the law. We don't see it a lot, fortunately, but anytime it's occurring, it's a problem. Mm-hmm. I think the issue, Dave, in particular with boats is, boats aren't easy to drive. They seem easy, but they're not like a car. If you think back when you learned how to drive a car, you had steering, you had brakes. If you got too close to the edge of the road, your parent or somebody could move the steering wheel for you or apply the brakes and call a timeout and get your bearings. You can't really do that on the water. It's a lot more difficult. And the problem with alcohol and mixing with boating out there is it can hide the effects of the alcohol a lot more. So you're out of you've got your equilibrium that is being disturbed from the rocking of the boat. So, the alcohol consumption and use can certainly increase the the actions of what's occurring out there.
You can. I get that. That's interesting. I mean, if you're adding even a touch of seasickness or just a sense of a slightly more higher struggle than normal to maintain your equilibrium when you're just walking around sober, you mix that. By that from the motion of the water, and then you add to that alcohol. I guess that's just another risk factor, you might call it, to put you in a place where you're less able to respond to sudden challenges, and those conditions that sort of layering on of risk really is a lot about what our laws are designed to minimize, from what I can gather. And in terms of the types of boats here, Is there, I mean, if you are apprehended for boating while intoxicated, does that go on your driver's license, or does that, how does that actually affect your standing or whatever?
Yeah, it's similar to that as driving a vehicle. It is a criminal offense. You're going to be processed, and it goes on record in the essence that you'll lose your privilege to operate a boat. It does not change the fact of being able to operate a motor vehicle on a highway.
Mm-hmm.
So the fines and penalties and such kind of vary. They're all going to depend on the, you know, how the case gets resolved in the court system.
Yeah, sure.
But yeah, you're facing at least a year loss of ability to operate a boat.
And I guess I got to ask the question about applying that to different kinds of boats, because I mean, you could have an incident where somebody's in a motorboat, which is registered with the DMV. You don't really have a license. So, well, actually I guess I'm going to stop on that right there in terms of being denied the authority to operate a boat, for a year. There's no license to take away in that case. How does that work?
Yeah, it's just another offense, that if your suspension is revoked from operating a boat, mm-hmm. You know, if you're under suspension, so to speak, for operating a boat, and you're found to be operating a boat, then you face a fine for that, you know.
I
as
see.
Well.
Okay.
I'll raise an interesting point here. I think that most folks don't understand, but if you look at the definition of motorboat in Vermont, it's basically, you know, any means of moving across the water. So if whether you're on a kayak, a canoe, or a floating picnic table, if you're out there moving across the water and you're using that as a means of transportation, that becomes a boat. That becomes a vessel under state law. And you can be processed for BUI for operating in those under those conditions. So it's not just, you know, a large motorboat that you can see a BUI. You can see a BUI in other ways as well.
So somebody in a kayak or a canoe, would that apply there?
Correct.
Wow. Okay. Good. I mean, that's interesting to know. And I suspect there this type of activity has occurred in Vermont, and I bet you'll agree, Sergeant, where somebody might be, you know, have this time of year, of course, it stays light late in the evening. So you have a couple of drinks with dinner. You might be actually over the limit for driving a vehicle, but you say, hey, let's go take the canoe out. You know, and you know, you're renting or own a lakefront camp or something, and just go down to the waterfront and grab your canoe and take it out. And now you are BUI, as you say, and I guess that is actually a crime. It's punishable. Is that right?
Yeah, you certainly could be. I mean, the effects of alcohol consumption into a person's body. I mean, even if you're under an 08, if you're under the influence, mm-hmm. that's an offense as well. So, you know, and again, you got to remember that the equilibrium issues will compound the effects of the alcohol, particularly out on the waterway. So it's something you got to be really be careful of.
Yeah, the old tippy canoe becomes more so, maybe. I don't know, but yikes.
Sure does.
Sergeant, I also wanted to talk to you about an issue which actually got into the news here a couple of years ago up on blanket on the name of the lake in Craftsbury there. But the questions about distances between boats, because, you know, sometimes there are conflicts of different levels. Some are just sort of budding and simmering, and others really get into a shouting match occasionally. Between, say, a motorboat with water skier or, you know, tuber, a person on a tube being towed behind it, they're out there racing up and down the lake having a lot of fun. Somewhere nearby, there's somebody in a kayak or a canoe or a little sailboat or something, and they are getting, shall we say, annoyed. What are the rules there? How far away is a power craft supposed to stay from a non-powered craft?
Yeah, can be a big issue out there in many places. So the way the law reads is you can't, you're not supposed to be within 200 feet, you know, at a speed of 5 miles an hour or more, which creates a wake. So if you're within 200 feet of the shoreline, a person in the water, a canoe, rowboat, another boat, a dock, any of that stuff, if you're within 200 feet, you're in violation. You know, we see that in Vermont's, a lot of the Vermont rivers that we have, Winooski River, Lamoille River, Otter Creek, folks take their boats up there and they don't recognize it. You know, they're within 200 feet of shore. That's a no wake zone. You're not supposed to be traveling more than 5 miles an hour, creating a wake up in those areas.
Wow. And so, I've often wondered, you know, one question is it really 200 feet? Do you have any good rule of thumb for people to use out there? You know, what is two-thirds of a football field, but then trying to imagine a football field laid over a lake? I'm still wondering here. How do you tell what's 200 feet?
Yeah. Well, that's kind of a good visual there. You know, it's difficult, but honestly, the best effort you can give in creating that good distance, don't be near. When you're operating a boat, make sure that you're paying attention, that you have an observer that helps you on the boat. Also pay attention. You really have to have your head on a swivel out there, and it's difficult. So having additional eyes can help you. Look for those folks that are swimming in the water. You know, if you're in a larger boat, it may be difficult to see the smaller kayaks and yep. Such. So, you know, it's just keep your distance, keep your operation under control, and take early evasive action. Even out in the middle of Lake Champlain, you got to start watching other boats, and they may be way off in the distance, but if you don't pay attention, you know, and you're headed towards the same point, you know, someone's got to mm-hmm. take action early and to help avoid those problems. You know, so I think additionally, if you mentioned towing somebody, you know, if you're towing a water skier and such, your boat has to stay 200 feet from everything else, but the skier, that distance goes down to about 100 feet. So
I see.
Excuse me. If you're operating the boat and you're towing somebody, you got to make sure that skier that you're pulling is at least 100 feet away from other stuff, other boats, people in the water, docks and shorelines, et cetera.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you really have to be alert out there, which gets us back to the advice against BUI, because, boating under the influence, because, you know, that just that can hamper your alertness and these things are important. I mean, tell me the prevalence of boating accidents. I mean, I know the numbers are really tiny in Vermont, but have we had boating accidents where it's basically a crash, where it's basically, you know, people who did not maintain their distance and got into big trouble because of that?
Yeah, unfortunately, we have. It doesn't happen often, but it does happen. And, you know, look, this is a meant to be a calm, relaxing, recreational sport. We want folks to have fun out there. But you can't get complacent. You know, you just have to kind of keep aware of your surroundings so that you can go out there. I mean, look, nobody plans for a tragedy. Nobody. So
right.
You know, it's something you just have to keep in the back of your mind that, hey, what we're doing right now, is that safe? And, you know, is there something else we should be doing? Should we slow down here? Things like that. So, you know, we want folks to go out there and have a good time, but be aware of your surroundings. Yeah. You know, like I said earlier at the start of the show, we don't have a lot of boating accidents, collisions, so to speak, but it can happen. It only takes one to become a real tragedy. You can put a lot of people on some of these boats, and it doesn't take much for something to go wrong real fast.
Speaking of a lot of people on boats, I want to bring in, let's have the listeners weigh in here, and I might have a couple of questions for you after, but let's go to Pan in Randolph. Good morning, Pan.
Good morning, sir. I have a question July 1975, which put me just a couple of months out of the requirements to obtain a boating license issued by the Vermont State Police. I'm curious why you haven't made one mention of that, and in fact that most all of the questions that have been asked would have been answered by anybody who had to take that class. Is that right or wrong?
A boating class to get a license from the Vermont State Police. What do you know about that, Sergeant?
Yeah, I didn't catch the initial.
Yeah, you were breaking up a little. Pan, ask your question again, because right at the beginning you sounded like you were getting muffled or something.
I'm sorry. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yeah, so I have a birth year of July 1975, which put me just out of date of the requirements to obtain a boating license issued by the Vermont State Police. And I'm curious why you haven't made one mention of that. I think that actually being born in Vermont, living 15 years in Florida, back in Vermont, I've spent most of my life on the water, and a lot of the water is common sense. A lot of people aren't born with that. Why haven't you made one mention of this license? Because most all of the questions that have been asked of you would be answered in having to obtain this license.
Let me ask, Sergeant, is there a requirement in Vermont for boaters to have a license?
Well, it's not a license, so to speak, as so much as it is a safety certificate. It is a certificate that if you're born after January 1st of 1974, you're required to go through a safety course. And that is for folks, like I said, born after that date. That's an eight-hour course if you're sitting in a classroom or if it's something
that's
taken online.
So have you not made mention of this because you think that people would not be involved or inclined to spend 8 hours? Like I said, it's 1975. I'm 45 years old. I had to spend this time. And I think that if everybody was aware of this and if people knew that they had to take this, whether they passed or failed, is almost irrelevant. The fact is that they went through the class and have a whole lot more knowledge than they did before taking it.
Let me just interrupt.
We have a lot of folks that come through this course. Folks that don't need the course will attend it just for that knowledge base.
Hmm. I got to say, this is amazing to me because, as I mentioned earlier, I have a little sailboat and have, taken it out sailing several times a summer for years, and I had not heard of this. I guess I better take a boating safety course myself.
I don't remember whether I took it so long ago. I don't remember whether it cost me money or not, but I can't believe that you're talking to this gentleman, and this is not like one of the first things you say, right? Like, oh, by the way, there's a class. Go take it.
Well, okay. I'm sorry we didn't get to that so far, but I'm glad we have some time left here on the show. Thank you for the call, Pan. Sergeant, where does one sign up for this class? Where are they held? How do you get access to this?
Yeah, the class is on we have an online course that you can access through the State Police website. And the classroom courses right now are sort of on hold just because of the pandemic that we're dealing with.
Yeah,
but those are, generally speaking, those are held around the state in classroom settings. We have instructors all over the state that hold these throughout the summer. And costs for those classroom courses are dependent on who's hosting them. So if a recreational center needs to charge for the use of a facility or a city hall or a private facility, there may be some small costs, although I don't think there are very many. The online course does have a cost. That is not that's charged by the online company that supports the platform for that course.
Okay, and so maybe I'm a scofflaw if I'm out on the water and I get asked for my certificate as having taken this class. And I wasn't born after 1974, so maybe I'm okay. But if I were younger, I might be a scofflaw. Because I didn't know, So what is it? Is there a fine for being out there without a certificate of some kind?
Yeah, there is a fine. Again, it's on a long list of fines here that I have for you. But this comes down to education. Some folks are not aware of it, but we very rarely. Come across anybody that is required to take this course that is not aware of it. It's it's one of those laws that's listed amongst all the boating laws in statute. It's like driving a car. If you're going to go do something and there's laws, that you need to be up to speed with those laws. So
yeah, yeah. Okay.
Like I said, it is listed there for the age for those that are required to do it.
Got it. Okay. We have another caller on the line, Chris from Williamstown. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
What's on your mind? Yes. What's on your mind?
I'm following up with the last caller, actually. I've been listening to the show, and it is kind of disturbing that, you know, I actually missed the due date, so to speak, by just 6 months, and I actually became a certified boating safety instructor and taught hundreds of kids this. And to have the officer that you have on the air to not make mention of it, I think is very well pointed out.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Chris. Appreciate it. I guess I'm going to forgive you here, Sergeant, because we have mentioned it now. And I'll say in general, just to the listeners out there, there are many times when I get into a topic here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM and AM, where it's kind of an exploration for me. I certainly do not have all the information myself, and I learn new things in the course of the conversation. Sometimes the things seem like they would have been in better order if I knew them at the top of the conversation, but if it's a half hour in, that's okay. That's the way the cookie crumbles sometimes. I'm not super upset myself. I don't know, maybe a couple of our listeners are a little bit out of shape, but I just sort of feel like, yeah, well, okay, now we're getting it out there. I'm glad we are. It's good information. And Sergeant, your advice to somebody who's interested in taking this course or feels they have a need to take this course, they should go to the state police website. Is there a particular link or tab there that they would follow?
Yes, that's correct. Right on the state police website, you can, on the left-hand side, there's several links of the various divisions we have, and you can click through the Marine Division and go through the safety courses. We have both snowmobile and boating links there.
Okay. Got it. Okay. Maybe there's some stuff we don't know about snowmobiling either. Probably a good idea to head over there and check that out if you are a snowmobiler or a wannabe snowmobiler in Vermont. I wonder, in terms of we talked about the distances. If you are not keeping a proper distance on the water, you can actually be penalized for that too. I'm sure there are on your long list of fines there. But let's talk about overall enforcement for a moment, because you know one question I have is a lot of these a lot of the lakes and ponds in Vermont are in places that are way out some dirt road somewhere in pretty remote areas. How thinly are you spread? Do you need more people to enforce these regulations?
Yeah, it's a constant evolving thing, Dave. We have approximately, I've got the numbers here. We've got about 15 part-time folks that are spread around the state that are out there. I think overall between we have Grand Isle Sheriff's Department and Colchester Police Department that are also part of our program. So between some full-timers that we've recently added this year as a program to augment the part-time program to get more folks out there, we've got around 30 folks that are out there doing this enforcement. Vermont is a big area. As small of a state we are, it's got a lot of waters on it. So we can always use more folks. Fish and Wildlife is also out there on the waters quite often. You know, they're working their Fish and Wildlife mission, but they're out there enforcing these laws as well, and they're spending a lot of time on the water. We are working, finalizing the details of them joining our program again next year in the actual recreational boating enforcement program. So that's going to offer an additional, 25, 30 wardens that will be out there. Directing their attention more towards actively addressing this recreational boating safety mission. So we look forward to that. You can always use more folks, but, it's an evolving situation. And as times change and things change and get forced upon us in law enforcement and public safety, we have to address and put people where they're most needed.
Yep, and I mean that makes sense. Basically, just try to manage the deployment to where, as you say, it's most needed. Do you feel like the need is growing in terms of just the numbers of voters out there? I mean, there are times when at somebody's water in the state, you go and you get out on the watery reservoir on a beautiful Saturday or something, and it can be kind of a traffic jam out there.
Yeah, it can. I think as the years have gone by, the paddlecraft industry has exploded, and we're seeing a lot more folks out there exercising, spending time out on the water on the paddlecraft. So they are adding a lot more boaters to the waterways. It's a good way to exercise, and in particular in years like this where, you know, folks have spent the last couple months, locked down, and they're looking to get out and get some exercise. We're seeing a lot of boaters out there this year.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. And of course, with the distance rules, 200 feet from other boaters, that's maybe the original social distancing. I don't know. But it is a way to, I guess, I don't mean to make a joke here too much, but I think there's a serious aspect of boating is actually another nice thing about it is it is a good way to kind of spread out a little bit and avoid crowded places and get out there and enjoy some beautiful nature in Vermont. Lots of good information, Sergeant. I really appreciate you joining me this morning. Interesting conversation. Maybe we'll do another edition at the start of next year's boating season. And in the meantime, I wish you good health and good luck taking care of the boating safety issues around Vermont this summer.
Yeah, let's do it. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Great. Hey, that's about it for the Dave Graham Show on this Friday, June the 5th. I appreciate all the listeners out there checking in with us and just listening in or calling or both. And it's always good. Let's do it again Monday morning. In the meanwhile, stay tuned for live news conference with Governor Phil Scott, other top state officials responding to the latest COVID-19. Have a good weekend, everybody.